Joining us now from Tehran is Professor Fouad Izadi at the University of Tehran. Professor, always a pleasure. Hope you're safe and doing well. A lot to unpack here. Number one, the agency, the IAEA itself, it's been time and again by Iranian authorities lambasted for not being impartial to Tehran and Tehran's basically effective cooperation with the agency that has been politicized against Iran, and it even provided pretext to Iran's enemies. That's one part of the thing. Then the E3 we want to touch upon to keep them from snapping back the mechanism under JCPOA, or I should say Security Council Resolution 2231, not to reactivate the snapback. And then when we say no hostile action against the country, we're also bringing in the Israeli regime and the U.S. So there's a lot to unpack here, Professor. Help us put it all into perspective.
You know, Iran is still a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and because of that membership, some level of cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency needs to happen. The problem is that IAEA, especially its director, Rafael Grossi, has been acting as if they are on the payroll of the Mossad. All these classified documents and data that Iran has provided to IAEA in a confidential manner ended up in Israel. So Iran is obviously quite upset about this fact. And what Iran will do from now on is going to be different from what Iran used to do, given the fact that Iranian nuclear sites were illegally attacked. So that's the first point. The second point is that we have the Europeans that think they can use the snapback mechanism. They have forgotten that they unofficially left the agreement 7 years ago, and it's not possible for a country or countries that are not participants of JCPOA to be able to use a snapback mechanism. But they are going to claim in the next few days that they can use a snapback mechanism. The agreement that you saw signed between Iran's foreign minister and IAEA secretary general is designed to prevent that idea of using a snapback. So what Iranian officials have said is that if the Europeans implement a snapback as they think they believe, they don't have that right. But, you know, UN doesn't have a leader, a boss. The UN system, the Security Council, has a rotating president. That rotating president is in office for just 1 month. Because of that UN structure, Europeans may think that they can use a snapback mechanism. But if they do that, then what Mr. Araghchi said in Cairo, what he has said since returning to Tehran, is that if Europeans decide to use a snapback, then that agreement is going to stop. Iran is not going to accept anything if a snapback is utilized. So I think what Iranian officials are doing are coming up with mechanisms to make sure that Europeans don't do what is not supposed to happen. It's actually not good for Europe to engage in those type of behaviors. And that's the basic idea. And this is what the statement today from Iranian National Security Council tries to emphasize.
Thank you, Professor. Always a pleasure. Stay safe, sir. Professor Fouad Izadi there joining us out of the University of Tehran. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister has strongly condemned allegations made in a joint statement issued by G7 members and allies as unfounded, irresponsible, and pure deflection. Ministry said such baseless accusations against guardians of Iran's national security made by those who've exacerbated insecurity and promoted lawlessness in various regions, in particular West Asia, said the U.S. and other G7 members must be held accountable for undermining regional security and complicity in Israel's genocide. Statement argued anti-Iran rhetoric is designed to distract global public opinion from the crime of the century being committed in Gaza. Iran called upon the G7 nations to end this erroneous, unjust criminal policy toward Iran On Friday, the G7 charged Iran with transnational repression and targeting political opponents abroad. Meanwhile, Israel is pushing ahead with its deadly strikes on Gaza and demolition of residential buildings, that is, in Gaza City. Latest figures put the death toll for regime's onslaught on Sunday at 18. At least four of the victims died in Israeli firing near an aid distribution center north of Rafah. Five others were also killed in airstrikes in southern Gaza City. Region is also enduring sustained shelling from artillery and naval vessels. In a separate attack, a drone strike on a tent sheltering displaced families in Deir al-Balah also killed six Palestinians, including women and children. Nearly 2 years into the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza, and over 65,000 nearly Palestinians have been killed and 164,000 wounded, and figures do not take into account thousands of victims trapped under rubble and never searched for amid unrelenting Israeli strikes. Palestinian officials in Gaza have released an alarming report on the extent of destruction of civilian infrastructure in Gaza City since start of the Israeli assault in August. The Gaza government media office said regime forces have completely demolished over 1,600 multi-story residential towers and heavily damaged another 2,000 buildings, adding Israeli forces have also destroyed 13,000 tents sheltering displaced Palestinians and forcibly displacing over 350,000 residents. The office described Israel's targeting of Gaza City civilians as part of the regime's campaign of systematic destruction, genocide, ethnic cleansing, and forced displacement, and slammed regime's campaign of destruction in Gaza City as blatant violation of international law and Geneva Conventions. Israeli settlers and forces continue daily violent acts against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Settlers attacked Palestinians in the village of Safa in Ramallah, as well as in two villages in Al-Khalil. Israeli forces also arrested at least 10 people during the raids in several West Bank cities. And for more details, we were earlier joined by Ramallah correspondent Naka Ahmed.
Settlers are attacking and encouraging to the Palestinian homes in the village of Safa to the north of Ramallah city. Safa has been subjected to many attacks by the Israeli settlers who are trying to cede more land to the ones that have already been seized. We are talking about a village that lost almost 90% of its land. And now the Israeli settlers have continued to attack the Palestinians while they are at their homes and while they are sleeping. Another form of aggression is that the Israeli settlers also have attacked the Palestinians to the south of occupied Al-Khalil, precisely in Masafer Yatta. We're talking about two assaults that happened to the villages of Beirin and to the villages of Atwane, both Bedouin villages that are subjected to many attacks and many assaults. Overall, in the West Bank, the Israeli forces has raided most of the Palestinian cities. We're talking about incursions towards Nablus, towards Jenin, Tul Kerem, and towards villages of Ramallah, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, and more than 10 documented arrests have been documented in the occupied West Bank only in the last 12 hours.
The United General Assembly has endorsed a New York Declaration resolution aimed at advancing Palestinian statehood. However, the measure has sparked controversy, with critics like Iran arguing it overlooks the root causes of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and fails to recognize Palestinians' right to self-defense.
Amid rising tensions across West Asia and the genocide in Gaza, the UN General Assembly has adopted a text endorsing a landmark declaration concerning the realization of an independent state of Palestine. The measure is known as the New York Declaration. 142 members voted in favor of it, 10 against, and 12 countries abstained from the vote, including Iran, Iraq, and Tunisia. The declaration, which was already endorsed by the Arab League, seeks to fully exclude Hamas from leadership in Gaza. Iran's UN mission has listed the reasons why it did not vote in favor of the resolution.
The statement fails to adequately address the root causes of the crisis in the West Asia region and does not provide a realistic solution to end the prolonged conflict. The statement ignores the reality of the Zionists' presence in Palestinian territories and their ongoing occupation. The statement irresponsibly shares the responsibility for continuing this long tragedy equally between the apartheid occupying regime and the people under occupation. The statement's attempt to condemn the Palestinian right to legitimate defense on October 7, 2023, and justify the disproportionate and horrific crimes of the Israeli regime against Palestinians in response to this right is utterly unacceptable and strongly rejected.
Iran's UN mission stressed that lasting peace in the region can only be achieved through the establishment of an independent, sovereign Palestinian state. The UNGA resolution also called for the disarmament of Palestinian resistance groups. Hamas and other groups say this contradicts international law, which recognizes the rights of the people under occupation. The UN General Assembly's vote came less than 24 hours after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said there would never be a Palestinian state. The New York Declaration vote precedes the upcoming UN summit co-chaired by Riyadh and Paris on September 22 in New York. French President Emmanuel Macron and several other leaders have promised to formally recognize the Palestinian state during the summit. Around three-quarters of the 193 UN member states recognize the Palestinian state proclaimed in 1988 by the exiled Palestinian leadership.
Venezuelan Foreign Minister Ivan Gilpinto has slammed the U.S. for escalating tensions with Caracas through conducting naval operations within Venezuelan territorial waters.
Those who give the order to make these provocations are seeking an incident that justifies a war escalation in the Caribbean. The incident reflects the shameful behavior of political sectors in Washington that irresponsibly commit very high-cost military resources and train soldiers as instruments to manufacture a pretext for war adventures, also undermining their own prestige and military honor by carrying out such a grotesque and excessive maneuver.
The statement follows an incident in which Venezuelan authorities said U.S. destroyers seized a Venezuelan fishing vessel within the country's national waters. Tensions are mounting between the two nations in the wake of U.S. military strike in the Caribbean that resulted in the deaths of 11 Venezuelans in a small boat. U.S. government accused Venezuela's leadership of involvement in the drug trafficking trade. The Trump administration claims its deployment of warships, aircraft, and nuclear-capable submarine to the Caribbean is part of a broader operation aimed at combating narcotics trafficking. In a response, Venezuela has mobilized its Bolivarian National Armed Forces across multiple regions, engaging in patrol and surveillance operations intended to safeguard the country's national sovereignty. Thousands of South Koreans gathered in central Seoul to protest treatment of the country's workers by the U.S. and President Donald Trump's crackdown on immigrants. Demonstration followed return nearly 300 individuals who've been detained by the U.S. immigration authorities and deported. Workers were allegedly held for visa violations while employed at a Hyundai-backed electric vehicle battery plant in Georgia. Protesters chanted slogans against Trump, saying, "Trump, leave the earth and let us take revenge on the USA." A Seoul protest reflects growing anger over what many consider to be unjust treatment of immigrants and broader discontent with policies of the Trump administration. Democratic People's Republic of Korea has issued a stern warning asserting planned war games by the U.S., South Korea, and Japan near its borders could have serious repercussions for the three nations. Kim Yo-jung, sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, condemned the drills as reckless demonstration of military power in inappropriate locations. South Korea's military claims drills are intended to enhance aerial, naval, and cyber capabilities in response to what it describes as Pyongyang's nuclear and missile threats. Park Jung-chan, the DPRK's senior party official, also warned Pyongyang will take countermeasures if the three countries continue to flaunt their military might.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
of my life, does everything with a smile. She's my mother, my sweet mother. She can take the pain away with just one look. That's my mother, my sweet mother. You're the picture in the frame with all the colors of the rainbow. I'm far from ashamed to say I love you so. And here I lay at home tonight. It's late but I can't sleep tonight. Forgive me if I take my time, but I just have to let you know you're so special. She taught me how to pray. We play games every day with my mother, my sweet mother. Even if I made no sense, you listen with patience. That's my mother, my sweet mother. She would sing a sweet song till I shut my eyes and kiss my head and say goodnight. And I feel safe with you by my side. You're there for every step in my life. I'm sorry if my love is unkind. I just have to let you know you're so precious. If only this was true. I'm in a cold, dark, wet room. I was an orphan, and now I'm 22. I've never known my mom. A picture faded by the sun is all I have. I'm left alone with nothing more but what I am. It's not enough, that life is tough when there's no one to call my mother, my sweet mother, my sweet mother.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Raditu billahi rabba wa bil islam deena. Raditu billahi rabba wa bil islam deena. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salam to you, dear brother, dear sister, in faith and humanity. So welcome, you are listening to today's special from IRIB English Radio, which in this program we're going to speak about turning setbacks into success. So be with us. On Sunday, we are here, 21st of the month of Rabi'ul Awwal, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 23rd of Shahrivar, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 14th of September, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. Let's learn more about the Holy Quran. For today, we listen to verses 124 to 125 of chapter Taha from the Holy Quran. We come back to the studio and we speak about these verses.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim.
ومن أعرض عن ذكري فإن له معيشة ضنكا ونحشره يوم القيامة أعمى.
And whoever turns away from my remembrance, indeed he will have a depressed life, and we will gather him on the day of resurrection blind.
قال رب لم حشرتني أعمى وقد كنت بصيرا.
He will say, My Lord, why have you raised me blind while I was once seeing?
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
These verses are a warning to those who turn away from the truth. This is because dread and encouragement might be mentioned beside each other and become fruitful. Some Islamic literatures indicate that leaving the path of mastership of Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, as well as leaving the duty of Hajj, having been counted as the denotation expansion of aversion, the remembrance of Allah. The purpose of straits of life is not lack of money and strengthened circumstances. While many of the rich, because of greed, fear, and anxiety, live in hardship and straits.
And to teach us the words of Allah, mercy and kindness and hope for everyone. Peace be upon you, O Muhammad.
And we have a topic from the last episode of today's special. And again, for today, we continue that, and that's entitled Turning Setbacks into Success. Every adversity, every failure, every heartache carries with it the seed of an equal or greater benefit. Life, much like sailing the open seas, is full of unexpected challenges. These challenges often manifest as setbacks, whether they're missed goals, failed projects, or unexpected crises. Setbacks are an inevitable part of life, but they don't have to be the end of the story. By embracing reality, reframing setbacks as learning opportunities, staying focused on the long-term vision, taking decisive action, communicating transparently, cultivating resilience, leveraging teamwork, celebrating small wins, and reflecting on your experiences, you can turn away setback into a powerful comeback.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to today's special. This is Ali, your host. Today we are going to talk about how to turn failure into success. Failure is a part of being human. Suffering defeat is something that everybody goes through. However, not everybody knows how to accept defeat gracefully and move on. Moving on to success is only possible if you become more resilient and find a way to turn failure into motivation. Brendan Burchard tells us that when we feel defeated, we must not struggle against it. Rather, we must accept the outcome. It is okay to feel disappointed, but we must try to move past that and shift into learning mode. We cannot learn from our defeats and failures if we beat ourselves up, feel sorry for ourselves. This is acceptable for a short period of time, an hour or a day or perhaps even longer under dire circumstances, but do not keep telling yourself that you did badly or that you are bad. Instead, accept that it is time to learn something. It is time to learn something new that will help you along the road to success.
Reflecting on different Islamic topics, short commentary of the Holy Quran, hadiths of the Infallibles, lessons from the life of the Infallibles, all in today's special from IRIB English Radio.
Now, what are benefits of failure? Really, it does have benefit? The biggest enemy of long-term success is complacency. History is littered with the stories of once great nations, culture, and companies that banked on the notion that the successful past guarantees a successful future. But failure has a way of motivating us, of keeping us hungry and also humble. People who know from experience that fortunes can be lost, that competitors never sleep, that downsizing happens, and that every market boom can go bust and to be more highly driven and much more intentional.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light that guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong. That often lies, 'cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
How can we learn from failure? Remember that failure does not define us and should not be a cause for concern. Instead, failure should be seen as a learning opportunity for development. So instead of being bogged down by failure, embrace it, learn from it, and use it as motivation to keep you moving forward, achieving your goals. The other thing that we can learn from is this fact that failure enables individuals to welcome challenges, persevere in difficult situations, and gain value insights from errors. Consider your setbacks and evaluate the factors that caused them. Inquire about the alternative approaches you could have taken, the insights gained from these occurrences, and how to implement these newfound lessons in upcoming scenarios. Approach a friend or mentor and seek feedback on returning from setbacks. And try new ways, of course. Utilize the knowledge from past failures to explore novel methods and take action.
The first thing that the Messenger of Allah is told in Surah Al-Ahzab, ittaqillah, be God conscious. People ask the question, why does the Quran inform the Prophet have taqwa? Doesn't the Prophet of God himself is the exemplar when it comes to God consciousness? Why should Allah say to the Prophet, ittaqillah? Yes, I remember one of the Abbasid rulers, Umayyad rulers, Al-Walid ibn Abd al-Malik, when he came into power, he said, anyone who tells me ittaqillah, I will behead them. How dare you tell me fear God? Because you know, sometimes people, when they come to advise some individuals, say, fear God, don't do this. Yes, don't you have fear of God? Yes? So it is seemed to be a rebuke. When someone comes and tells you, why don't you fear God, is viewed by human beings as being told off. Yes? Not in the Quranic sense. In the Quran, when Allah says to the Prophet, ittaqillah, there are three possibilities. Either it is emphasizing that the Prophet is already the exemplar when it comes to taqwa, number one. Number two, it is not necessarily to the Prophet, as we said, because ya ayyuhan nabi, it is for everyone, yes? So it is iyyaka a'ni, it means I am speaking to you, but the main addressees are the mankind. Or thirdly, it is a special adab, it is an etiquette that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala uses in the Quran when it comes to addressing his prophets, including the Holy Prophet. So when he addresses the Prophet of Islam, he addresses him in this way. That's why the Prophet of Islam would say, "Adabani Rabbi fa ahsana ta'dibi." The one that taught me adab and etiquette and akhlaq is Allah. In a beautiful narration, he says, "Ana adibullah." I am the product of the teachings of Allah when it comes to adab. Wa Aliyun adibi. And I am the one who taught this to Ali ibn Abi Talib. Yes? Therefore, what do we find? This is considered to be what? The possibility.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Today's Special from IRIB English Radio. Inshallah, we'll meet you soon. Till then, fi amanillah.
They told me that I'm crazy, who you're praying for. They told me there is nothing, who you're looking for. Stop doing what you're doing, cause there is no hope. Just come with me, I'll show you what's behind your door. And they showed me all kind of lies. My eyes were locked, yes I was mesmerized. But deep inside I know that there's a better world. Cause I'm a believer. I'm a believer.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
It's one of the simplest yet most powerful words in the Islamic world, unity. And every year for 1 week, Iran marks it in a very special way. From the 12th to the 17th of Rabiul Awwal on the Islamic calendar, the days between two dates claimed as the birth date of the Prophet Muhammad, Iranians commemorate not division, but togetherness. They call it the Week of Unity. We'll be right back. But beyond the ceremonies and conferences lies something far more important. The lived reality of Shia and Sunni Muslims in Iran. A reality often denied, distorted, or dismissed by a Western narrative that thrives on suspicion and conflict. This week we go behind the headlines, behind the propaganda, to witness what unity really is and why it matters. The idea of a week of unity was born in 1980. Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, made a bold move. Where history saw differences, he saw opportunity. Sunnis celebrated the Prophet's birth on the 12th of Rabiul Awwal, Shias on the 17th. Instead of letting that divide deepen, he declared the days in between a bridge, a week of unity. To start with, we talked to Mr. Abdul Hossein Khosropanah, an Iranian Shia cleric and a professor of philosophy at the Research Institute for Islamic Culture and Thought. He is also secretary and member of the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution since January 2023. He said unity is not a matter of choice. It is both a religious obligation and a rational necessity.
Muslim unity is both a religious and rational obligation. Creating division, whether by Shia or Sunni, is sinful. Imam Khomeini and the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, have always emphasized this, seeing unity not just as a defensive necessity, but as a foundation for building a new Islamic civilization. History shows that whenever Muslims were united, such as during the Buyid era, science and culture flourished.
Imam Khomeini didn't ask Sunnis to become Shias or Shias to become Sunnis. He asked Muslims to be Muslims together, to emphasize what we share: God, the Prophet, the Holy Quran, and the hope for justice.
Mr. Khosropanah emphasized, however, that unity does not mean erasing differences. He said that Sunni and Muslim scholars must join forces to confront the greater challenges of our time.
None of our great scholars, whether Ayatollah Brujerdi, Imam Khomeini, or the leader of the revolution, ever said unity means one sect must abandon its beliefs. Shia and Sunni scholars can and should discuss differences respectfully and academically. But today, there are far more pressing challenges than sectarian disputes. Secularism, relativism, and atheistic ideologies are pushing youth toward disbelief and moral permissiveness. These are the critical issues where Shia and Sunni scholars must cooperate. Likewise, in advanced sciences such as quantum technology, biotechnology, or artificial intelligence, no single Muslim country can succeed alone. By dividing responsibilities and collaborating, they can avoid falling into modern forms of dependency and subjugation.
The Holy Quran itself calls for this bond in chapter 3, verse 103. Hold fast to the rope of Allah all together and do not be divided. A command, not a suggestion. We also had the opportunity to meet with Mr. Maulavi Muhammad Ishaq Madani, a prominent Sunni scholar and former member of the Assembly of Experts for Leadership. He emphasized the importance of unity not only between Shia and Sunni Muslims, but also among all followers of divine religions.
The Quran commands, hold firmly to the rope of God and do not be divided. If we fight among ourselves, we weaken and lose our strength. The Prophet said, be brothers forever. Do not strike each other's necks. He compared believers to bricks in a wall, each strengthening the other. The Holy Quran also reminds us that all prophets, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, peace be upon them, brought the same divine message. Just as we respect our prophet, we are obliged to honor all the prophets.
and the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, built his community on this principle. In Medina, tribes and cultures blended into one ummah. It was unity, not wealth or power, that turned Islam into a global force. But unity has always had enemies. For centuries, colonial powers understood that a united Muslim world was the one thing they could not control. Their answer? Divide and rule.
Our enemies, whoever they may be, use division as a tool for domination. The old saying goes, divide and rule. Even before Islam, this strategy was used. For example, when Jewish tribes settled in Medina, though small in number, they fueled conflict between the Aws and the Khazraj tribes, allowing themselves to dominate. And it was the Prophet of Islam who united these tribes, and the plotters then became his enemies. Division has always been a weapon of domination, and it is still being used against us today.
The strategy was brutally effective, stoking suspicion, fabricating lies, turning brothers into rivals. Shias were branded as heretics, Sunnis painted as oppressors. The damage was not accidental, it was engineered. For Mr. Khosropanah, the concept of unity extends beyond Iran. He sees the global resistance movement as its natural outcome, a front where Sunnis, Shias, and even Christians stand together against occupation and oppression.
The global resistance movement is another fruit of unity. The Zionist regime targets both Sunni and Shia leaders alike, whether it be the Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, Ismail Haniyeh, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, or General Qasem Soleimani. Their struggle is shared. Before the revolution, even Lebanon's Shia community was fragmented, manipulated by colonial powers. Today, however, resistance unites Shia, Sunnis, and even Christians in Lebanon. Attempts to disarm Hezbollah fail because many Sunnis and Christians also see its weapons as essential for Lebanon's security. This shows that the theory of unity directly leads to the theory of resistance.
The professor of philosophy at the Research Institute for Islamic Culture and Thought also pointed to the ambitions of the Zionist regime, whose plans for expansion threaten the entire Muslim world. Division, he warns, only makes it easier for such enemies to prevail.
We also face a common external enemy, the Zionist regime, which seeks not only to occupy Palestine, but to expand from the Nile to the Euphrates, threatening parts of Syria, Iraq, Turkey, Egypt, Qatar, and even Iran. Such ambitions endanger all Muslims, Shia and Sunni alike. Unity is necessary to resist this cancerous tumor. The Quran warns that division weakens us, and once weakened, enemies can easily destroy us. Their goal is not limited to Gaza. They seek to fragment nations and enslave peoples.
Western empires knew very well that if Muslims stood as one, foreign domination would crumble. So they invested in division, sometimes with guns, sometimes with whispers. At the Azadi Hotel, we met several Muslim scholars from different countries who had come to Iran to participate in a conference marking the Week of Unity. Among them was Sidi Mohammadi Quadrego from Burkina Faso.
For the West, it makes no difference whether a Muslim is Shia or Sunni. Their goal is to weaken Islam as a whole. I see Islam like a body. Shias and Sunnis are its limbs. If the limbs fight each other, the enemy can easily sever the head. Disagreements among Muslims should never destroy their shared purpose. Our goal must be unity, otherwise the enemies of Islam will exploit our divisions, as we see today in Gaza and elsewhere.
Today, the echoes of that policy live on in extremist groups, in sectarian wars, and in the headlines of Western media, eager to portray Islam as fractured and Iran as divided. But here's the truth. On the ground in the streets of Iran, the story is very different. Ms. Zainab Salem, a Muslim researcher from Iraq who has been living in Iran, shares the impressions of visitors to Iran, who discover a society very different from the image shown abroad. Lively, secure, and thriving through Islam. For her, Iran's strength is living proof of the power of unity.
A relative of mine recently visited Iran from Canada. She was surprised to see how lively, joyful, and secure life is here, completely different from the negative image presented abroad. True life and dignity come from living by Islam, its beliefs, and its values. Iran is proof of this. In medicine, education, science, and culture, it thrives through Islam. Foreigners may deny this, but those who visit with their own eyes see the truth. Iran's strength is the strength of Islam, and unity here is real in a way the outside world does not show.
Meanwhile, another guest from Pakistan shared his experience of living in Iran. Mr. Sayyid Hassan Reza Naqvi, a PhD candidate at the University of Tehran, has been residing in the capital for the past 5 years.
I have close ties with Iranian Sunni students in Chabahar, Zahedan, Gulistan, and Gurgan, as well as with Pakistani students across Iran, since I'm responsible for the Urdu-speaking Student Association. From what I have observed, the relations between Shia and Sunni youth in Iranian universities are an example for the rest of the Muslim world. In some countries, Shias make up 25% of the population, yet they have no presence in government, not even as a mid-level manager or a military officer. In another country, Shias make up nearly half the population, yet they have no governors. By contrast, in Iran, the governor of Sistan and Balochistan is a Sunni Baluch. Sunnis also serve as members of parliament, professors in universities, and officials across different sectors. Sunni and Shia students face no restrictions. This culture of inclusion and mutual respect in Iran should be presented as a model to other Muslim countries. Unlike elsewhere, sectarian sensitivities do not dominate relations here. Students treat one another like brothers. Personally, I'm very happy to see it.
During the 8-year Iran-Iraq war, when Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist army invaded with Western backing, Shia and Sunni Iranians fought side by side. Thousands of Sunnis gave their lives defending their homeland. In those trenches, unity was not a slogan, it was survival. When the bullets came, they didn't ask if they were Shia or Sunni. They were Iranians. They were Muslims. They were brothers.
From the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has faced attacks, whether from terrorist groups like the MEK, separatist groups in Kurdistan, or extremist movements in Balochistan. These groups shed both Shia and Sunni blood. During the 8-year war, Sunni scholars and fighters stood shoulder to shoulder with Shias in defense of Iran. At every stage, unity has been the key to survival.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines. Welcome to the news section of the program, where we take a look at different headlines from different news outlets. Mehr News. Tehran celebrates Islamic Unity Week with cultural festival. A cultural festival was held in Tehran with the presence of Foreign Minister Sayyid Abbas Araghchi, Tehran Mayor Ali Reza Zalkani, along with officials, ambassadors, and representatives of various countries. The Rahmatan Lil Alamin Festival, coinciding with Unity Week, showcased the cultural and religious traditions of various ethnic groups in Iranian provinces. IRNA, Islamic Unity Conference to convene in Tehran with participation of global scholars. The 39th International Islamic Unity Conference was held with the participation of 80 prominent scholars, 210 guests, and 2,800 activists from across the Muslim world. The event was attended both in person and virtually by scholars and intellectuals from various countries. Speaking at a press conference, the Secretary General of the World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought outlined three dimensions of unity, including domestic, regional, and international, saying domestic unity in Iran has served as a model for the Muslim world, citing examples such as the broad solidarity displayed during the 12-day Israeli war against the country. Shahriari noted that thousands of statements and Friday sermons by Sunni clerics after the war reflected a shared commitment to unity, with a collection of those sermons soon to be published. He also dismissed claims of division, saying rare incidents are often exaggerated by hostile media to undermine solidarity among Muslims. Tehran Times. 63 coins bearing Prophet Muhammad's name to be unveiled in Unity Week. Iran unveiled 63 historical coins inscribed with the name of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, for the first time during Islamic Unity Week. Hamid Reza Soleimani, head of the Dafine Museum's group, said the coins were presented on Sunday, September 7th, at a ceremony marking the 1500th anniversary of the Prophet's birth. The event took place at the Shahid Zahidi Hall of the Mustaz'afan Foundation in Tehran, he added. Soleimani said the 63 coins symbolizing the years of the Prophet's life were selected from the foundation's treasury of historic currency. Following the unveiling, they will be on public display for 2 weeks at the Astana Quds Razavi Museum in Mashhad. The collection includes some of the most prominent gold dinars and silver dirhams from across the Islamic world, Soleimani said. The oldest coin dates back to the 7th century CE, while the most recent belongs to Iran's Qajar period. He said the coins span multiple dynasties, including the Abbasids, Samanids, Aghlabids, Tulunids, Ghaznavids, Ghurids, Seljuks, Ilkhanids, Timurids, Safavids, Afsharids, and Qajars. Their geographic origins include the Indian subcontinent, Central Asia, Iran, Mesopotamia, the Levant, and North Africa. Ilna. Pezeshkian emphasizes need for strengthening Islamic unity. Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian and head of the National Iraqi Alliance, Sayyid Ammar al-Hakim, emphasized the importance of unity among Islamic countries. In a meeting on September 8th, the Iranian president highlighted that ongoing collaboration among Islamic nations is essential for development and resilience against the external pressures. The Iranian officials believe that continuous unity and cooperation among Islamic countries in all areas will not only pave the way for development and progress, but no power will be able to sanction or defeat Muslim nations, Pezeshkian said. Regarding Iran-Iraq relationship, the president reaffirmed that geographical borders cannot affect the deep-rooted ties between the Iranian and Iraqi peoples, which are fortified by shared religious and cultural bonds. He warned against divisive issues that could undermine Islamic unity, urging vigilance against plots by adversaries aiming to create discord. This brings us to the end of this section. Please stay tuned as we go back to our main narrative. Today, that unity is visible at the highest levels. An example is Shahram Irani, a Sunni from Kurdistan who commands Iran's navy. His rise to leadership is more than personal success. It's proof that segregation walls are not what outsiders claim. In Iran's Sunni-majority regions, from Kurdistan to Sistan and Balochistan, mosques are active, Friday prayers are held, and Sunni representatives sit in parliament. Their voices are not silenced. Their faith is not hidden. But this is not the story told in the West. Instead, Iran is painted as a land of sectarian oppression, where Sunnis are silenced, where unity is a mask, where division festers beneath the surface.
One of the most important lessons we can learn from Iran is the model of representation and coexistence. Here, even non-Muslims, I mean Christians and Jews, can vote and hold seats in parliament. This is a remarkable example that other countries should adopt. It shows that Iran recognizes humanity and human dignity, rooted in both the Holy Quran and the teachings of the Prophet and his family.
And when misinformation fails, violence is manufactured. Groups fueled by foreign support preach sectarian hatred, bomb mosques, and claim to speak for Islam. But their mission is not faith. It is fracture. Mr. Naqvi recalled the early days of Israel's war on Iran when he witnessed a spirit of unity, not only between Shia and Sunni Muslims within Iran, but also between the people of Iran and Pakistan, standing together in the face of a common enemy.
بیش از 5000 دانشجو در ایران داریم.
During the early days of the war, on the second day, the Pakistani embassy asked all students to return home since universities and dormitories had closed. They even arranged transportation to the Mir Jave and Ramadan borders. At that time, there was no internet access except in the embassy where I stayed connected. Many families, including parents of Sunni students, called me. Some pleaded with me not to send their sons and daughters back to Pakistan. They said, if you send them, send their bodies. This is a battle between truth and falsehood. We do not want our children to abandon it. Even if they cannot fight, at least let them remain present. I remember crying as I heard this voice from Sunni families who were ready to see their children martyred alongside Iranians rather than withdrawn. It was a true manifestation of unity between Shia and Sunni Muslims.
Every year in Tehran during the Week of Unity, a wide variety of events gather scholars and leaders from across the world. Sunnis, Shias, dozens of nations. They sit at the same table, argue, debate, and agree on one simple truth: Islam is stronger when united.
این نمونه خیلی تجربه خیلی خوبتر که
The Week of Unity in Iran is an inspiring experience. Here Sunnis and Shias, Hanafis, Shafi'is, followers of the Ahl al-Bayt all sit together, study together and emphasize the Quranic command that says hold fast to the rope of God all together and do not be divided. The message is clear. Unity must not remain words, but must be put into practice. If Muslims work for this goal, they will achieve honor and strength.
I came from Iraq to present a paper at this conference. Since this morning, I have learned so much from the discussions, and I am convinced that Muslims must join hands against common enemies, America, Britain, Israel, who constantly plot to divide us. My paper is about Tawhid, or monotheism. I believe that when people truly understand Tawhid, they will also understand the necessity of unity, because unity is rooted in God's oneness.
They come not to erase differences, but to fight a bigger enemy, ignorance, extremism, and the colonial echoes of divide and rule. In the words of the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, this is not politics, it is faith. God himself has commanded us to unite. And if Muslims were united, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, these tragedies would never have happened. And when the Iranian nation faced foreign aggression, Molavi Madani said Sunni scholars and communities stood firmly beside their Shia brothers, defending the homeland with one voice and one spirit.
During the so-called 12-day war imposed on Iran by the Israeli regime, Sunni scholars unanimously supported the Islamic Republic and its leadership. Not a single Sunni joined the enemy. On the contrary, they condemned the aggression and defended the country alongside their Shia brothers. The unity and defense of our homeland is a shared value for all Muslims in Iran.
But unity faces its greatest enemy not on battlefields, but in the hearts and minds. Ignorance, suspicion, myths. Some Sunnis are told Shias worship their imams. Some Shias believe Sunnis reject the Prophet's family. Both claims are false, both designed to wound. These misconceptions don't survive where people actually live together. In Iran, Sunnis and Shias share neighborhoods, workplaces, even families. When you know your neighbor, you don't believe the lies.
The idea that Sunnis do not respect the Prophet's family is a blatant lie. Even in remote villages, if you ask a Sunni what they recite in prayer, they will say, "Oh God, bless Muhammad and the family of Muhammad." This is universal among Sunnis of all schools. In